Good morning and welcome. It's Saturday, it's 10 a.m. It's time for Final Draft. You are on 2SER 107.3. My name's Andrew Popel, and as always, it's books, writing, it's literary culture. It is Final Draft. It's also the last weekend in November. All year, we have been bringing you Australian classic literature in our Australian Classics Book Club the last Saturday of every month. This is no different. In fact, it is our last Australian Classics Book Club for 2017, and we're ending on a high note. One of Australia's most important writers, Henry Handel Richardson, and we will be talking about her seminal work, The Getting of Wisdom. As always, I'm joined in the book club by David Winter. He is a senior editor at Text Publishing, who bring us the fantastic Australian classics that we discuss. I'm also joined today by Stephanie Convery. She is a deputy culture editor at The Guardian. This is going to be a fantastic conversation. Do stay tuned. It is all coming up after this short break.
2SER and Mistletoe present the return of Non-Stop Party People, Chick, Chick, Chick.
Sometimes it's one of those nights, and you never have to happen to you. Then you go home too soon, go home too soon.
One of the world's most dynamite live bands, Chick Chick Chick, bring the mayhem to a peak at Oxford Art Factory on Thursday, December 14th. Tickets on sale now from Rosh Tix. Chick 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 and Mistletoe are proud 2SER sponsors.
What do you do when your job is taken by a robot? Where does all your e-waste go? How do you split your digital assets when you break up with your partner?
This is Think Digital Futures. Each week, an exploration of the moral and mind-boggling questions that face us in the digital age. Tune in Sunday mornings at 10:30 and Tuesday evening at 6:30. You can also listen on your favourite podcast app. Just search for Think Digital Futures.
It is that time of the month again. You are on 2SER 107.3. It's Final Draft, it's books, and it is the Australian Classics Book Club. And it's November. This is our last Australian Classics Book Club for the year. I am excited. I want to introduce my two guests in the book club right now. I am joined, as I have been all year, by David Winter. He is a senior editor at Text Publishing, and Text produce the amazing text classics that we draw our books from. I'm also joined today by Stephanie Convery. She is a deputy culture editor at The Guardian. David, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you.
It is really exciting to come to the end of a year of classics, and thank you so much for joining me. I'm hoping people are going to look back and go, well, I've got Christmas sorted with 10 great books. But before we get too excited about the end, I want to introduce Henry Handel Richardson's The Getting of Wisdom, which is the book we are discussing today. Now, The Getting of Wisdom tells the story of Laura Rambotham as she leaves home age 12 to board at an exclusive school in Melbourne. When we meet Laura, she is the revered and slightly feared older sister of three siblings who delight in her stories and worldly knowledge. Also a loving thorn in the side of her mother, who can't understand why she's not able to govern herself more strictly. But arriving at school, Laura quickly discovers she's the bottom of the heap, and her learning and intelligence have none of the discipline required for a formal education. This is just a beautiful book, and I hope we're going to discuss the many ways that that I enjoyed it and that you both have obviously enjoyed it. But David, let's start. Can you introduce us to the author known as Henry Handel Richardson?
Sure, Andrew. Well, Henry Handel Richardson left Australia at age 18, but like Randolph Stowe half a century later, she returned often to the country in her writing, and she wrote two of the most significant and enduring novels in Australian literature. She was born Ethel Florence Lindsay Richardson in Melbourne in 1870. Hers was a wealthy family. Her parents had been English migrants, and her father had been a doctor on the Victorian goldfields. He died when Henry Handel Richardson was 9, and the family moved back to the goldfields area. Her mother became a postmistress. Richardson went to PLC in Melbourne from age 13, and controversially that became the model for the school in The Getting of Wisdom. She left for Europe with her mother in 1898, and as a talented pianist, she studied music in Germany. She soon met and married a Scottish-born literary scholar, and they settled in London, and that's England was where Richardson lived for the rest of her life. She adopted the pen name of Henry Handel Richardson, so it's a famous 19th century tactic, of course, for a woman to adopt a male nom de plume. Her first novel is called Maurice Guest. It was published in 1908, and many, many words were cut from the published version, some of them because it was considered a little too racy. It's a dense and difficult novel. It's an account of a love affair between a young English student and a young Australian woman in Germany. It was her second book, The Getting of Wisdom, which was published in 1910, that really gained Richardson a lot more readers. It was a much easier proposition. It's an apparently autobiographical coming-of-age story. It's a modern novel. Germaine Greer reminds us that it's as fresh and loose-limbed as Maurice Guest is clogged and crabbed. Henry Handel Richardson herself just referred to it as little. She was not she never made big claims for the novel. But as Greer tells us, lightness does not mean that it lacks profundity. It was filmed in 1978, I think, by Bruce Beresford, and the novel echoes through Australian literature, probably most recently in Rebecca Stafford's memoir, Bad Behaviour, from a couple of years ago. So Richardson returned to Australia only once in 1912 to research her next works of fiction, which became her magnum opus. Three novels eventually published in 1930 as the trilogy, The Fortunes of Richard Marnie, which is a vast portrait of Australia in the late 19th century based on the life of her father. That was followed by a short story collection, a final novel, which didn't meet with much acclaim, and an unfinished autobiography. And she died in Sussex shortly after World War II finished. Her reputation rests on The Getting of Wisdom, which is a compact and, I think, nearly perfect little book, and The Fortunes of Richard Marnie, which is vast, more than 1,000 words, more than 1,000 pages. It's a real epic. Neither book is matched in Australian literature, in my opinion.
So, we're really ending on a bang here. We have an absolutely amazing Australian author. We have an absolutely amazing book. And something that we have done this year, David, is we've picked books that are really a very nice introduction to an author's works. If the listener hasn't encountered Henry Handel Richardson before. Now, The Getting of Wisdom, I was really fascinated with the title, but also the conceit of getting wisdom, particularly as it juxtaposes with the idea of learning and acquiring knowledge. Laura, as I introduced, is leaving for school. She's very reluctant to do so. She doesn't really quite see why she has to. And throughout her misadventures at school, Laura is constantly kind of wrong-footed by not quite knowing what she has to do. So she studies her books, her peers, her instructors to understand what's expected of her. But at each turn, she seems to miss some crucial understanding. That what I think is that wisdom that we're getting at in the title. What was your reading, either of you, on this idea of getting wisdom?
I found that process of just my initial reaction when I read the book, the process of her trying and failing to fit in at every turn, incredibly anxiety-inducing. The first time I read it, I was just like, why are you doing this? Why can you not see what's happening? But, I mean, that is obviously something that Richardson she's come to writing this book with the knowledge that Laura doesn't have. It doesn't matter what she does, she's never going to fit in because she's just not the same kind of person as the people around her. She doesn't have the kind of temperament that allows her to, like you said at the end of the book, to be the square peg in the round hole. Hang on. To fit into the hole that has been created for her, or the space that society thinks that she should fit into. And her, like, the imagination that she comes at the world with, the kind of frankness and just simple curiosity that has been dampened down in all of her schoolmates, it means that she can't do what's expected of her because it just feels so unnatural.
There were several times during the book where I asked myself, and I'm going to ask both of you, whether Laura's circumstances have something to do with where she's come from. Is it peculiarly the nature of being exterior to Melbourne? She's come from the country. Is it something to do with the fact that while she's going to an exclusive school and her family are fairly genteel, they're quite poor? And then I kept reminding myself also that even at home, she seemed to be that square peg. She didn't quite fit in. Her sister is constantly a little bit exasperated and fearful for her. But do you think Laura is an absolute unique?
I think that I don't think she's absolutely unique, but I think that that kind of imaginative space that she inhabits in her own mind means that it is difficult for her to kind of to push herself into a mold. And I mean, I was thinking about this book when I was reading this book. It reminded me a lot of Anne of Green Gables, not in the narrative or even in the way that it was told, because that story is much more kind of florid and you know, very, very dense emotionally. But her kind of the wonder that she kind of approaches the world with means that it's always going to be difficult for her to find her place. I'm not really sure if there's an end to that thought, or if it really answered your question.
Well, I think there's a little bit of a hint of Amy Whiting's Eye for Isabel as well. You're talking about sort of young girls, young women who they both have a thirst for knowledge, but knowledge doesn't really bring them wisdom. They can't fit in with the people around them. They will eventually find one or two people who they're simpatico with, but it's that sense of just bumbling through the world, and it doesn't really matter how sophisticated their own thought processes are, because they just haven't learned those sort of operating rules.
Mm. I was always tempted to find Laura heroic as our protagonist to really want to identify and admire her. There are times when she's absolutely beastly, and I think I'm saying beastly because of how often it's mentioned in the book. And it's interesting that her most, horrific rebuke at the hands of her peers is when she works the hardest to ingratiate herself with them and to be like them. She takes a trip to, I forget the exact relationship, but he turns out to be a distant family relation, and there's a bit of a crush going on, older teacher,
the curate.
And she goes, and then when she returns, she invents this story about the sort of the torrid affair that she's had, and there was a stolen kiss, and when it's revealed, she's a pariah at the hands of her peers, and that's the hardest she had actually worked to ingratiate herself with them. And it's really when she betrays herself and this uniqueness that she has that she suffers the hardest.
But that scene where she tells them these terrible lies, she knows she's under pressure to deliver a story, to deliver romance, and so things just blurt out. And then late in the book, she says of her lying that she doesn't know why the lies just came. And so at every point, it's just sort of a coping mechanism. And it rarely she schemes in fairly noble ways, such as, I will work really hard, I will knuckle down, and then people will be impressed by me. But her sort of, if you like, her quick and dirty ways of ingratiating herself are totally unplanned and really cack-handed, and she often is just sort of, you know, doing the face palm almost immediately after lying, because she knows she's going to come undone.
Even when she does kind of knuckle down and try her hardest to, you know, do things the right way, she doesn't, like, it's almost like she can't win. I don't want to spoil the ending for people, but when she cheats, you know, it's almost like she's kind of given up on even the right way of doing things. It's like, well, actually, it doesn't matter what I do. These people, you know, I'm never going to be what everybody wants me to be. And I think I kind of feel like the realization of that is very, that's the wisdom that I feel like she's trying to get to through the whole book.
This is the perfect time for us to take a break. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're on Final Draft in the Australian Classics Book Club, where we are discussing Henry Handel Richardson's The Getting of Wisdom. I'm joined by David Winter from Text Publishing, Stephanie Convery from The Guardian, and we're going to come back after this track. This is from Alex Leahy. It's a bit of an old one. It's called Every Day's the Weekend.
You say House Cult Film Classics finishes up at Event Cinemas George Street on December 8th with their version of a Christmas classic, Die Hard 2. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. Hosted by Channel 7's Jabba and Quinny from Supernova. Grab tickets at eventcinemas.com.au and stay tuned for next season's reveal. Event Cinemas George Street, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Hi, I'm Lenore Taylor, the editor of Guardian Australia.
And I'm Rebecca Huntley, researcher and writer.
We've made a new show called Common Ground.
It's where completely different Australians have genuine discussions about the issues politicians fight about.
I don't think politicians are representing Australians anymore. They all seem to have an agenda and there is absolutely no faith in them, I know that.
Common Ground, 7:30pm Mondays or podcast anytime. 2SER 107.3, stories, ideas, music.
Welcome back. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. You're in the Australian Classics Book Club on Final Draft. We just heard a track there from Alex Leahy, Every Day's the Weekend. It is the weekend. We are discussing Henry Handel Richardson's The Getting of Wisdom, and I am joined by David Winter from Text Publishing and Stephanie Convery from The Guardian. The Getting of Wisdom is Laura Rambethan's journey through school and her enlightenment, her education, her getting of wisdom. There's this dreadful paradox that's put on her, and I gather all of her peers, all women in society. So we're talking, in terms of context, we're talking about a book that is more than 100 years old, set 100 years ago. And I felt it was really sort of typified by the comment that her mother makes to her in a letter early in the book where I forget exactly what Laura has revealed, but her mother says, I'd much rather have you good and useful than clever. Now, that in itself seems kind of damning against the idea of the expectations on women and their education. But then Laura goes on immediately after to say that she knows her mother doesn't really mean that, and put to task, it's not quite sure how her mother would come down. Perhaps she'd prefer Laura be clever, but just that, just the tension of that paradox to be good or clever, but maybe the two are not mutually exclusive. A girl that's too clever can never be good. Must weigh heavily on her, I imagine.
Yeah, her mother is a sort of strange. She's a strange figure because she's both sort of heavily conformist and then has these quirky streaks. And she's raised Laura, and you sort of, I don't know, maybe I just invented this, but I always got the sense that she was really quite proud of Laura being a bit different. But she just, by the same token, she had to kind of say, you know, be good, fit in, you know, etc. Do your work, but. Yeah, I don't know how you both feel about that.
I feel like, well, I mean, she goes out of her way to kind of make Laura appear different, and I think she knows that she's doing it. Like, you know, she dresses her in these, like, extremely vibrant clothes with the knowledge that, you know, she says, I shouldn't dress my daughter like she's an old maid before her time or something at one point when she's buying this hideous purple gown for her. I mean, I sort of feel like she's the representation of that tension for women at the time, you know, that all of these things are expected of them and all of those things are so contradictory, it's impossible to be everything at once.
We talked a little bit about colour off air, and I'm going to confess on air, I don't know why I'm confessing something on air, but I read a book like The Getting of Wisdom and it takes me back to my childhood where I had the illusion that the past was in black and white. Did you ever have that as a child? The past
did
was
you,
in black
Did you have a black and white TV growing up, Andrew?
I don't think we did. Maybe I just watched The Wizard of Oz too often. Yeah. And I love the colour in this book because it reminded me that, and there is something very dour about when Laura goes to school. You could almost imagine the school days in black and white, and especially the moment when not the principal, but she's told that, you know, girls wear a white pinafore, not a black pinafore. And I'm like, it's all just black and white. And then there are these beautiful splashes of colour from her mother. And when colour appears, it's this sort of reminder. It rips us away from the dourness of the school. And really, as much as Laura might fight against it, it reflects so much of who she is as a person.
Yeah, she's always in colour, Laura, like whether it's the awful purple dress or the hideously bright red lining of the hat that, of course, her mother sewed on, and or her red cheeks, you know, embarrassment, mortification. She's always flaming up in embarrassment, and I can sympathise with that. as someone who'll go red in the face, it's an awful feeling as a teenager, you know, like you're just almost on fire. So, yeah, there is a really nice contrast in the way that this is. It's very, I think it's pretty subtly done, but there is almost this kind of black and white and then into technicolour whenever Laura is, you know, involved in, so there's a sort of critical scene or whatever.
But this also brings us back to the other thing we were talking about off air, which is this tiny passage about synesthesia. There's a point where Laura talks about, or Laura is made fun of in class for saying that a word is grey-blue. The word itself has colour. And it just occurred to me then, perhaps what's happening here is actually Laura thinks in colour, and what the school is trying to do is make her think in black and white. And she's pushing back against that in all sorts of ways, but she doesn't quite see it like that yet. Her upbringing has been kind of removed from all of that, all of those social codes and so on. And so you can tell at the beginning of the novel that she feels like she is the centre of her little universe. And I mean, for better and worse, right? She's got a certain sense of herself, which is then obviously, it takes a beating when she gets to school. At the same time, she is kind of naive in that as well. Like, these things are, that naivety is almost kind of ingrained in her by the time she gets there. And, you know, you feel for her when she's going through these moments of sheer humiliation and, you know, consistently coming up against walls wherever she sort of turns in the social stakes and so on. At the same time, you kind of hope she doesn't lose it. Like, you want her to fit in because you want her to be happy, but at the same time, you really hope she doesn't lose what it is that makes her distinct.
And, I mean, it's probably fair to talk about the fact that she is so unrepentant and ultimately unchanged. She really goes through. I mean, it's a bit of a trope of some fiction like this, that the individual goes through trials and ultimately becomes a part of the group, you know. They find friends, they find their clique, and that becomes their friends for life. And Henry Handel Richardson goes to great pains to tell us that she has friends that she keeps in contact with and ultimately loses touch with and never hears from again. Because Laura, she gives us this really oblique reference to not telling us exactly what Laura does, but that she really does get to see, I guess, a reward. She gets her wishes in life, which... it's kind of what I found. I thought that was kind of wonderful.
Yes, there's that line, a beautiful line, which reminded me so much of, I mean, I went to a Catholic girls' school very close to PLC, not PLC itself, but nearby. And that line, "With these and similar promises, the three girls parted, they never met again." Oh, it's just so, like, yes, that is exactly what happens, actually. You have these, you know, deep emotional relationships with people at school, and then they just sort of fizzle out and everyone goes their separate ways. But also, yes, those people that she was so close to at school that kind of adhered to those morals and social codes that she resisted the whole way in, you know, unconsciously and consciously, and also tried desperately to conform to as well. Ended up, there's a line, MP married and settled down in a native township. Yeah. Cupid went a governessing and spent the best years of her life in the obscurity of the bush. Whereas Laura, for all her, you know, non-conformity, manages to have her aspirations fulfilled. And yeah, I mean, it's gratifying to kind of see that, yes, the square peg that doesn't fit in the round hole can still have a fulfilling life. In fact, that kind of seems to be what Richardson is sort of arguing for obliquely.
One of the aspirations that Laura fulfills, we presume, again, it's only obliquely referenced, is to get out, to experience the world, to travel. And I wondered if there might be some sort of cultural critiquing of Australia going on here. You mentioned the home in the bush that MP is sort of relegated to. And there's also another moment where Laura is visiting her godmother, I'm pretty sure I've got this right, and she's looking for some entertainment because she's basically been left alone. But it was a bookless house, like many Australian houses of its kind. There's this real sort of cultural...
Yeah, there's a reference to colonial girls a couple of times as well, you know, as a sort of, as a great mass of, you know, not particularly appealing young women or whatever, so, yeah.
I mean, and this book was written from London, I think. I've got that right from your introduction, David.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there's some perspective being put back on the whole experience of growing up Australian that Henry Handel Richardson found lacking.
Yeah, I think that it was perhaps a little rich of Richardson to think that she could come back to PLC and be welcomed. She definitely burned a few bridges there, and I don't think that her attitude towards Australia was particularly kind. I think she was certainly interested in Australia, and I don't think anyone could write The Fortunes of Richard Marnie without a great degree of sympathy for the place, but there's a fair bit of shade in this novel towards young women of that era, as well as the institutions that are housing them.
I also feel like she actually thinks Australian men are kind of idiots. All of these kind of right. references to the boys that kind of that hang about the school, and also even the men in the school, and they just seem just like they're vile, like they're really, really awful. They're either just careless and self-centered, or they're just like horrible to the women in their lives. So.
Well, they barely exist in this book, and that's kind of great. They're really one-dimensional and savagely treated. But, I mean, I guess a lot of this book is quite satirical, but it just does it with such a light touch that it's only really now as we discuss it that I realise how nasty some of the characterisation is.
You are listening to the Australian Classics Book Club on Final Draft on 2SER 107.3, and we are discussing Henry Handel Richardson's The Getting of Wisdom. I want to say thank you to David Winter. He's a senior editor at Text Publishing and has been my companion in the book club all year. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks, Andrew. It's been a great year of classics, and thanks, Steph, for a great chat.
And yeah, thank you also to Stephanie Convery. She is Deputy Culture Editor at The Guardian. She has joined us for The Getting of Wisdom. Thank you so much, Steph.
Thank you for having me.
We are almost out of time. I want to say a big thank you again to David and to Stephanie for joining me in the Australian Classics Book Club. Now, The Vulture's Nest is coming up next. If you want more Final Draft, if you want to listen back, if you've missed anything, go to 2SER.com, search for Final Draft. While you're there, why not click on the support button and become a 2SER supporter? Your contributions are so important to what we do here. We're a volunteer-run station, we're community. It's all about making great radio, and you can be such an important part of that. We are coming back next week with more Final Draft. There's only a few shows left in the year before we go on a break over Christmas and summer. I'm Andrew Popel. I'll see you next week for more Final Draft. Bye now.